Alrighty, good evening, everybody. Happy Tuesday. Hope you all had a good week. This is Jeff on Moving Train Radio in New Jersey. We've got Heidi and Dave in Minneapolis, and we've got a special. Our topic is NASA and space exploration, and our special guest tonight is Kathy Hagen of Virginia, Northern Virginia. She lives in the Washington, D.C. area. She's got a great interest in the space program, and she was fortunate enough to go to an event at the Goddard NASA Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, which is just outside of Washington, for people that are familiar with the Beltway area. And she's going to tell us about what she did that day. And then we're going to talk about space program, our own memories of it. We're different ages, so we have different points of view. Then we'll see how it goes. So I'm going to turn it over to Heidi, and then we'll turn it over to Kathy.
Okay. So Jeff was saying that you'd spent some time at the Goddard Center. Now, Goddard Center is where is this in Houston?
No, it's right outside of Washington, D.C. It's about 15 miles. Outside of Washington, D.C. in Maryland.
Oh, okay. So were you a member? Did you have anything to do with NASA itself as far as, an engineer or not, obviously not an astronaut or whatever the
no.
correct term is currently?
I sure wish I were an astronaut, but
Yeah, we all do.
Actually, my father worked for NASA. My father,
okay.
he actually worked for what was called NACA, N-A-C-A, which was the precursor to NASA. And it was, and actually what NACA stood for was the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. Boy, I hope I have that right. And it was, NACA was actually started in the early 1900s, right around when the first airplane went up. I think like 1915, I think, NACA was started. And NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, started officially in 1958, and Dwight Eisenhower, who was president at the time, started. And my father, whose name is Jack Hurkett, he was in the Air Force, joined the Air Force during Korea, and was absolutely an enlisted man, not an officer, not a scientist in any way, but it was just a matter of right place, right time type thing with my father. He ended up working for a place that really did not exist. And I don't know how many people really realize that NASA, a lot of the groundwork for NASA was done by a place called NSA, the National Security Administration, which, in quotes, did not exist. People
right.
who worked there did not say they worked there. There was not a term, that anybody, you're having coffee somewhere and you say, oh, yeah, I work for NSA. You never said that. I mean, it just did not exist. So my father, among other things, worked for NSA in the early days in the 50s and ended up at NASA and worked on every launch of every unmanned and manned space flight from the late 50s through the 70s. Up until his death, and ended his career at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, their satellite, NOAA satellite service. So that was what my dad did. And so
wow.
I learned.
Is that Wallops Island?
Actually, my father has been to Wallops many times. Wallops is actually technically in Virginia, although it's in the water that's considered Virginia, but it really is more Maryland. You park your car in Maryland and you end up at the end of this ramp that puts you in Virginia. It's kind of weird.
Yeah,
but
I've been there. It's right at the border. Yeah.
Yes. And so Wallops, that's another place that I grew up, you know, knowing all about Wallops, you know, that space thing, it's so funny. I learned on NASA Social Media Day, the day that I ended up being so lucky to go and spend the day at Goddard Space Flight Center, I found out there's a name for people like me, and we're called Legacy. We're called NASA Legacy. And I call myself a NASA brat. I always called myself that. Never heard that term before. I made that up, NASA brat. But we are called Legacy. And I was told that by an astronaut when I was at NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center, on Social Media Day. So it took me many decades to find out that there was a name for me.
Wow. And they give you a job?
Yeah, boy. I'm telling you, I was like, hey, I can take notes. I can, you know, I can mop really good. I can mop a floor like nobody's business. No. Wouldn't that be nice? I would love to work there. That would be a dream come true.
So I was going to ask, what you did, Adla, when you became an adult, you didn't yourself work for NASA, but like I said before, and I think all of us that are of a certain age, and maybe everybody that's an American, you know, to a certain extent wishes, you know, that they had, you know, a father, a brother, a sister, a mother, someone that was in, you know, one of the program, you know, one of the space programs, you know, whether they, you know, had something to do with the Challenger or something to do with, you know, anything that happened in the 60s. And, you know, it's one of those things that even though I have absolutely no aptitude for you know, the math and science that it takes to be able to be an actual astronaut or you know, work at NASA and those types of you know, those that capacity, it's always one of those dream kind of ideas to be able to be, you know, work for NASA or be involved in it. Was that kind of your take as well? Was it kind of that's a lot of stuff that you have to know, obviously, to be part of NASA? I mean, it's a lot.
Okay. It's so fascinating. I mean, you know, the changes that we've gone through in the United States when it comes to what one would have, you know, the kind of credentials you would have to have, you know, like, Heidi, I hear the awe in your voice, like, oh, my gosh, you know, I don't have enough happiness to be able to, you know, to be able to be to work at NASA. You know, I feel that way, you know, science.
Right.
But what has changed? Oh, my gosh. I mean, exponentially. All right, when you talk about my father was born in 1933. All right, he lied about his age to get into, to enlist for Korea. One of his buddies, you know, my father's from Philadelphia. He was born in and raised in the city of Philadelphia. Really, really, you know, low-income, Irish Catholic family, right? I mean, no money for college. No money. Okay, and also, to add a little bit more human interest, my dad was pretty much a juvenile delinquent, okay? And so one of my dad's buddies from high school, who was older, a couple years older, he was in the Marines, and he was killed in Korea, like in the very early days of Korea. So, of course, what did my father do? He and his buddies all went out and got drunk, and they all went to the recruiting office, right? We're going to be Marines, man. We're doing it for Joey. You know what I mean? And, you know, so they tried to be Marines, and the Marine recruiter was like, go down the street to the Air Force because we don't want you, right? So they all ended up enlisting in the Air Force, okay? And that's how my dad started his path. It was so much of it was luck, all right? And a lot of it was because my dad had no fear. He was not afraid of anything. And my father did not go to college. Okay, he went and took some night classes after he started working for NASA. He took some night classes at American University, which is in Washington, D.C. And, you know, my father's official title at NASA was physical scientist. Okay, and he did not have a college degree. All right, so now fast forward to 2015. Okay,
right.
I walk into NASA and I say, guess what? I want to work here. I'm really smart. I have a high school diploma. What do you say? And I mean, it's not, you know.
Yeah, they you'd be able to take the trash out, or maybe you'd be able to
wash
the windows or something.
Right. So it's very, very interesting. It's so, you know, there's so many different, you know, reasons why the fact that my father worked for NASA was almost like a miracle. But that is not to take away from him. He was, I mean, back in the 50s, he was that guy that, you know, they said, okay, we need a volunteer, and we're going to send you up in a tin can in the middle of a field. Anybody? And my dad would raise a chance. He was one of those adrenaline junkies, right? And, you know, that's how he ended up, you know, in the Air Force. You know, he did a lot of that kind of stuff. It was all top secret. Ends up at NSA, National Security Agency, at Fort Meade. And then, you know, they pick him and say, hey, look, you know, we got this big, huge room that takes up the whole floor of this building in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we know it's July, you know, 1955, but you got to bring your winter coat. And he's like, okay, whatever, right? Brings his winter coat, and it's a computer, right? So there was the first ever computer. You know, the UNIVAC, you know, IBM, you know, he was a contractor for IBM, you know, all these other computer companies. And that's how he got on board with all that. So, you know, it's so funny, you know, fast forward to February 2nd, 2015, when I was at the first NASA social media day. And here I am at Goddard Space Flight Center, where, I mean, I grew up. You know, that was not a big deal to me. You know, it's so funny, and I don't mean that in any way a show-offy type thing. You know, I was one of five kids, and it was just where my dad worked.
Wow.
And, I mean, you know, it was funny. Anyway, so that's how I ended up. And really, tangentially, you know, that wasn't even a reason I was chosen to go to the first NASA social media day. It was really almost chance that put me there. And they had no idea that I was a legacy. They had no idea my dad worked there. I filled out an application that I had seen on Twitter that NASA, because being a space geek, you know, I follow a lot of NASA accounts on Twitter, and there are some really great ones. I mean, if you never sat down and said, you know, I don't know if you're big on Twitter or whatever, and said, I'm going to sit down on Twitter, and I'm just going to go on the hashtag NASA or the hashtag ISS, International Space Station. Go on there, and the world that you will have opened up to you, you will have so much fun. I mean, it is just so much fun because NASA is really great at social media. I mean, they get it. They know that's the way people like you and me and my daughter and my grandchildren, you know, how they, you know, that's how they connect with being a space geek. Look up, you know, that's another great hashtag on Twitter, look up. You know, that's really a fun one. So I filled out an application, and The application was for NASA Media Day, Social Media Day, and it was to go to one of the 10 NASA facilities in the United States, and you can pick.
Mm.
So if I wanted to go to Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, because I don't know if any of you all watched Big Bang Theory, which I happen to love that show, that's where Howard, one of the Big Bang Theory guys, works there. He works at Jet Propulsion Lab. And I could have, if I had chosen on my application to go there, I could fly myself out there, pay for it myself. I could have gone, and they chose me, I could have gone to JPL. You know, so I chose Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, because, you know, I'm exaggerating when I say this. It's my old stomping ground, you know. So, you know, and also I could just drive around the Beltway and I could get there. I could leave in the morning at, you know, 6:30 in the morning and be there at 7:30 in the morning. So that's why I chose there. And by just, I mean, I don't know what NASA's criteria was for choosing a social media person. There were 25 people chosen for each facility in the United States. And
okay.
I do not know what their criteria was. Just because I'm one of those people that, I was going to say I'm a pessimist, but let's just say I'm a realist. I figured there was some attrition there. In other words, maybe some other people were chosen ahead of me, but they couldn't go or something like that. So I just think that there was a lot of things happened that put me there. And let me tell you, when I walked in the door on February 2nd, my eyeballs, I was like a 5-year-old on Christmas morning. I swear to you, that's how I felt. That's what I can liken it to, the feeling that I had. I felt like I had been given a huge gift.
Yeah, you know, we've actually, you know, went to the Cape Canaveral, you know, where you can go out to where the space shuttle goes out. You know, just amazing. Like the vehicle that moves the shuttle, which is just like, you know, and I'm assuming you've probably seen it. It's gigantic. There's no way to describe how large it is, or and how they get it out there, and where they put it up, and you know, you drive up to this thing that doesn't look so bad until it doesn't look that large until the guy that's the tour guide tells you, by the way, that American flag is 5 stories tall, and you go, holy crap, it's like a dot on this building. It's just amazing, and you know, there's levels of geekdom that you can reach when you go out to these places. I'm sure I went through level 10 just going out there. And if anybody hasn't done it, it's not so far from Orlando, but it's just amazing. And like I said, I could have probably spent 3 days out there just looking at what they saw and just, you know, and then the last time we were out there, they allowed you to go into Mission Control.
Yeah.
And it's hasn't been touched for decades, so it's still got that like 70s kind of look, maybe mid 80s look to it. So, you know, you're just in your head all the history, all the stuff that they've seen, and all the things that happened from that particular room is just one of those things that, like I said, I could probably have spent, you know, days there easily.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, major geeking. But I was going to say, one of the things that I forgot to mention to Jeff was that Dave actually has relatives that have worked for NASA as well, and he can tell you more about it, because I don't know as much, and I'd sound like an idiot if I tried to talk about it like he can. But do you want to share about your uncle?
Actually, my uncle worked on the space shuttle program. He helped design the toilet systems. That's all we really know, because he really couldn't talk about much about what he did. But my grandfather, Webb, actually is one of the people who helped define radar astronomy. I don't know if anybody knows this, but Project Diana, for which my mother is named, was the first time that we ever sent satellite or radio waves to the moon and had them bounce back.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, so it's there's some there's a little geekiness in Dave's family. So it's good, cool, very, very cool stuff.
Oh, my God.
I was able to play in the basement with this oscilloscope, which actually I have. I inherited from when I died. But he explained to me all his equipment. Of course, I was really young at the time, so I had no retention of what he said. But all of his equipment and all of his history is just really fascinating as well. And obviously, the stuff that he did was in the early 40s, so it predates NASA. I got to clear my throat. But just the work that they did, and the fact that now that they're using radar astronomy to map out other planets, meteorites that are going by, asteroids, it's just all really cool stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Very, you know, it's one of those things that, it's so uniquely American. You know, I mean, you could talk about Russia and you know, China, but NASA is so uniquely American. Other country has anything to the level that we have regarding this particular issue. You know, and how it came about and the history with JFK, you know, wanting to go to the moon and what it means to us as a country and what it's done for us. Do you have any other, do you have any information about that, or what do you know about what space exploration has done for us collectively?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I mean, you know, and I have that sense of awe. I can hear it in your voices, you know, it's funny how I hear you and others apologize and say, oh, you know, I know it's, you know, I sound like such a space geek, blah, blah, blah. See, that is very contagious. And, you know, our kids, you know, our grandchildren, our acquaintances, you know, people, I know there was one person who usually calls in on the show on Tuesday night, Jeff, and I'm not sure his name, and he said on Facebook, oh, I have zero interest.
You know, I was going to call the commie, but I can't even call the commie because the commies are as interested in space as we are.
One thing is, even him, I almost commented on Facebook and said, please listen anyway, because see, the thing about me is, you know, I am not a professional. You know, it's. The story that I have is very unique, you know, and it's very, it's contagious. That enthusiasm is so contagious, and you don't have to, you know, be schooled in, you know, astrophysics to be able to, you know, light the fire under somebody and say, oh, my gosh, you just don't understand, you know, as a kid, what this did to me, you know. And I've got to say that JFK, John F. Kennedy, when he was president, and I mean, it's mind-boggling to me the short length of time that man, you know, was president, and he was very flawed as a president. Okay, I'm not even going to talk about, you know, as a human being, but you know, mm-hmm. as a president, I mean, that man, so much was expected of him. Okay, but one thing that he did that's very interesting as far when we talk about 2015, he was got along very well, and I don't mean just in a professional capacity, with the then president of NASA or the director of NASA, whose name was James Webb, and John Kennedy. And I really think that it was another one of those kind of, you know, lucky things that he really, they enjoyed each other's company, they enjoyed each other's intellectual dialogue, and James Webb, you know, everybody's heard of the Hubble telescope. And mm-hmm. one thing that I learned a lot about on NASA Social Media Day on February 2nd, just a month ago, I learned a lot about the Hubble and the fact that it's going to be done in 2020. That's the last time we'll see pictures from the Hubble. And that,
wow.
I mean, that made me, I mean, and I knew that it at some, on some level I had known that date, but I probably learned it in 1997 or something like that, you know, in the early days, and it meant nothing to me. You know, it was like
is there,
25,
is,
you know, the year 2525, right? You know, it doesn't mean anything, you know, and
right.
you know, but now the next telescope is the James Webb telescope, and you know, he was the director of NASA in the early 1960s, and I know 1962, 1963 worked very closely with John Kennedy. And I think that James Webb's, you know, that visceral adoration of space, you know, that you and I were sitting here talking about right now, even from lay point of view, that visceral adoration of space, he,
mm-hmm.
I think, ignited the fire in John Kennedy.
Yep.
And, you know, for him to write that speech that Jeff quoted on the Moving Train Facebook page for tonight, for our talk tonight, you know, when you read those few lines, okay, and you know, that he could light the fire, and I keep saying that, you know, and I have very, very in the front of my mind that, you know, Robert Goddard back in 1926 took a can, put some gas in it, and I'm really filming this down, obviously, lit a match under it in Auburn, Massachusetts, and, you know, up it went, and there it all started. That started it off, you know, and I'm telling you, all it takes is for you to be standing in a field at the age of six, you know, at near Greenbelt Lake, which is right near Goddard Space Flight Center, and standing there with my father with a model that we made in the basement, lighting a match to it and watching it go up, and the thrill. I mean, you know, there really is something a very basic human thing, you know?
Yeah, it is just so amazing, and you know, we had a couple of chances to see like one of the last space shuttle liftoffs, but it always the one time that we were in Florida around the Orlando area around the time that we could have went, of course they scratched it because of weather, but have you ever been to a shuttle launch?
I've never been to a launch. I was very lucky in 2012, and it's almost just what you were talking about, Heidi. In 2012, I watched the Endeavour get transported from Naperville to Launch Pad. And my gosh. Okay, you know, the only thing I can liken it to, and I hope that this doesn't sound too blasphemous, is when they took Abraham Lincoln's body on the train after he died, and they said that everybody was completely silent. When that, you know, little children, you know, 2-year-olds, 5-year-olds, you know, we're watching that train go by, and just that sense of awe, you know, that this is such a great moment. Well, when I saw that, and it's exactly, Heidi, what you were saying about this, just the sheer scale of it. Okay,
yeah.
You know, here we are, you know, the stuff when we were kids, we were like, man, cool, you know, the stuff that impressed us. You know, you're standing there, and, I mean, people were lined up. You know, this is Florida, you know, Orlando, you know, like you were saying, pretty much. And people are lined up on the street, and you're going to get your coffee at 7-Eleven, and you didn't even know it was going to happen. And you're coming out, and you're standing there. And it's like, this is America. It's so American, you know. And yeah. And you know, you do talk about, you know, you did mention Russia, and which is very interesting, you know, from my standpoint, you know, being a child of the Cold War, you know, when the Soviet Union, it was Soviet Union, and you know, from that, the fact that my father, you know, you have to think about, all right, think about maybe how your dads were, you know, if they were Eagles fans, or they're Vikings fans, or they're Redskins fans, okay, and Sunday, you know, it's Championship Sunday, and the Eagles make it to the championship game, and they lose. And your father, it was like your mother said, nobody is allowed to say a word. Everybody go to your room. Nobody talks. Nobody bothers Daddy, okay? Because, I mean, let me tell you, I lived the whole 1960s and part of the 1970s walking on eggshells like that because my father worked on every launch. Okay, and I mean, you know, you have to remember, there were so many high points, and the low points were absolutely, you know, I don't know if you ever have thought about it in terms of the NASA family, okay, you know, not just my household down the street from Goddard, but the NASA family, I mean, you know, we definitely, you know, it is a huge, huge tragedy, you know, tragedy, loss that affects us for the rest of our lives. You know, when Apollo 1, you know, with Gus Grissom, you know, in the you know, it was a test. It was just
that was the first disaster that I remember.
Yes, I mean, oh my God, I mean, you know, it's just, and you know, yes, my mother told us, you know, don't anybody make any noise, okay? And I'm laughing, I'm joking about that with you now. But, you know, we, even as children, didn't even have to be told because it was part of us that happened to. It was a terrible thing, you know? And you know, it, you know, in our little young lives, that was a very terrible thing, you know? And you know, so...
I was gonna say that is, you know, I mean, it would be kind of funny to have all, I mean, everybody that I know that geeks out on this stuff is just, you know, it's just exciting just to listen to it. And, you know, you become fangirl and fanboy, like, oh, my God, remember this? Everybody starts talking at that, like, high level. Oh, my God, did you see that?
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's, you know, one of the things that I remember from several years ago is, when they were talking about defunding NASA or stopping, you know, funding or cutting it severely, and they do, you know, NASA is, you know, the money that they get is nowhere near what it, in my opinion, what it should be and or what it was in its heyday. You know, there's been a couple of, you know, disasters, of course. And, you know, and when you look at the length of time that NASA's been around, you know, it's not. Their disasters are you know, pretty minuscule considering the length of time around. But you know, I think one of the things that gets lost in the oh, it's cool, it's space is also what they've accomplished and what we use and what we have today that we never would have or maybe we would have had 40 years from now or 50 years from now. And one of the things that, you know, when I was kind of doing a tiny bit of research for tonight, one of the things that I found was just five things that we have because of space exploration. One of them, if you all pick up your cell phone, because I'm sure everybody has one, your cell phone camera was created, if you will, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the 60s. They developed the first concept of the digital camera, and in the 1990s, they worked to make cameras so small that they can, you know, sit on those spacecraft, but you know, still actually send back a picture that made sense. You know, that they're not all pixelated. You know, so 1/3 of all cell phone cameras contain the technology developed from that research. So if you think, I mean, that's just amazing.
I'm glad you mentioned that because one thing I will always remember, one of those crystalline moments, you know, it doesn't matter who your dad is or what he does, he's still your dad, and you think whatever he says
right.
is probably not true, okay? And I remember being a kid, and my father, and I don't even know if you all remember this, you know, Jeff, maybe you do, they used to call them charger plates. We did not call them charge cards, okay? They were called, or credit cards, they were called charger plates, okay? And I remember going to somewhere like Corvette or something like that with my father. And Corvette,
mm-hmm.
for anybody who doesn't know, it's like a Walmart, maybe a little bit nicer than Walmart, not quite as nice as JCPenney, okay? And we're at Corvette, so my dad takes out his charge card, and we're standing in the line, and he showed me the charge card, and he said, you see this charger plate? And he said, Kathy, do you realize, and this is like 1968, do you realize that someday you're going to have a telephone, and it's going to be this big?
Wow.
And I'm looking at my father like, this guy is so drunk. Okay, I mean, you know, I'm serious. Disconnect, right? It was a disconnect. This guy is not dealing with reality. And he said, someday a computer is going to fit in this, it's going to be this big. And I remember that like it was yesterday because people don't realize that you would not have an iPhone if it
right.
weren't for the Apollo program. You would not have
mm-hmm.
an iPhone. You know, I was laughing the other day. Somebody posted a picture from the mid-60s or the early 60s. Remember I was telling you about my father working on the first computer, and it took up the whole floor of a good-sized office building, right? And, you know, we had to wear his winter coat because it had to be kept, you know, practically refrigerated, this computer, because of all the tubes and everything, right?
Right.
And, you know,
yeah.
Right. I remember that, you know, my father had told me that what was used on the nose cone of the space modules, okay, for NASA, they worked hand-in-hand with Corning. Okay, so Corning glass, Corning cookware, you know, everybody's got that quintessential, you know, Corningware casserole with the little blue cornflowers on the front. Okay, they would not exist if it weren't for the Apollo and the Mercury mission, because that's what the nose cone was coated with. Okay, and then it turned out, I don't know if you all remember, but one of the shuttles went up and the tile flew off during liftoff. And it was a huge
mm-hmm.
thing because it wasn't on the level of Apollo 1, which was, you know, the deaths of all three, you know, astronauts, including Gus Grissom. It wasn't on the level of Apollo 13, okay? But they were afraid that that thing was really, that was going to be a bad thing. They didn't even know if they were going to be able to get them back, those shuttle astronauts back, okay? And they really, really tweaked. They said, look, that nose cone and those tiles, they're light, yet during reentry, when that heat is so unbelievable, you know, that's the tough part. You know, going up is one thing, coming back, that's when a lot of problems happen. And so they're like, it needs to be lighter, it needs to be stronger. And that's where your screen of your iPhone was invented. Okay, so you would not have, let alone, you know, and it's so interesting that you talk about that camera because, you know, I remember Jeff on the Moving Train Facebook page, you know, had posted the selfie that the astronaut just up on the, you know, the space station just posted a couple days ago. And then today or yesterday posted the selfie, which was a selfie. Somebody had put a comment that said that was not a selfie, but Buzz Aldrin took that picture of himself.
Yep.
Okay, so it was a selfie. All right, but you're so right, the camera. I mean, and you got to remember, Goddard Space Flight Center, you know, it's not Cape Canaveral, it's not Mission Control in Houston, it's not the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. But what they do at Goddard is they're sitting there with the box. They've got the box, and they're saying, whatever it is, it's got to fit in this box. Remember that from Apollo 13? They're like, all right, we've got to make something that's going to get these human beings back in the tin can from outer space, but it's got to fit in this box. Okay, that's what they do at Goddard. And I saw some of those boxes that they're still working on now for the manned space flights, for the new James Webb telescope that's going to be on. And you know, we just don't realize how much, oh, my gosh, how much we owe. And also, Heidi, you had mentioned the budget for NASA. And it's something that really, you know, that's probably a whole other moving train talk, because we could talk for an hour about it. But just briefly, the budget, one thing that people don't understand, I was just talking about how, you know, the quantum leaps that we've made since the early 60s to now for, you know, space travel, okay? But another thing that has to be recognized is that the changes that have happened in the United States as far as lawsuits, as far as liability, okay? You know, back in the day when the Mercury 7, which was the original 7 astronauts, were chosen, okay, and they were chosen by NASA in April 1959, if I've got my date right in my head. Okay, so a year after NASA was born, they chose the 7 astronauts, and I'm telling you that one of the criteria was, do you mind if we put you in a tin can, put a can of gas under you and light it? Is that okay with you? And you signed a paper and said yes, and that's where your liability ended. Okay.
Right. And they were all test pilots.
Yeah.
Really, all the flights from the first Mercury manned flight up through Apollo were progressive test flights.
Right.
On the way toward working their way towards actually landing on the moon. It was really, I mean, I remember everyone. Oh, do I have to turn to talk now? I remember we watched every liftoff in school on TV. They wheeled a TV into the classroom.
Oh.
And,
yeah.
And, you know, during science class, we talked about, you know, how the, you know, with diagrams, how the Apollo was going to work with the lunar module, and you know, every you know, with the exception of Apollo 1, each Apollo flight took it a step further. Like, first it went like as far as the moon, and then it orbited the moon, and you know. That first time that after 1968, which was a disastrous year, it ended, if you remember, or if you know, with that the
with
visual
Apollo 8.
Of I forgot which Apollo it was. It was before 11.
Apollo 8.
Coming back from the dark side of the moon and watching, and the picture of the, it was first time the picture of the Earth, you know, the Earth as a planet, you know, in the middle of the dark. It was breathtaking.
I remember. Yeah, I know what picture you're talking about.
Yeah, the picture's
talking
about Earth.
Whoever the astronaut was, who he read, I think he read a Bible passage or something. And you don't need to be a churchgoer to have been, you know, just moved by that. It was just such a way.
Right.
What a way to end that year. And,
oh my
and
God!
I want to say a couple other things. As this whole thing was going on, like during the whole decade of the 60s. As each thing happened, there was never any doubt that they were going to pull it off. I don't remember, you know, the audacity of JFK in 1962 saying you got 8 years to put a guy on the moon and land him on the moon and bring him back. The audacity of that is just mind-blowing. I can't imagine any American president today saying, challenging anybody to do anything of that magnitude.
Jeff, I was going to say, you know what makes it even more remarkable is we're talking the 60s. We're not talking the 2015 where, you know, I have a camera that's tiny. I have a GPS system in my phone that can tell you where I am at any time during the day. We're talking the 60s. We're talking...
And they were learning as they went along. But all throughout the whole thing, there was no doubt that, well, maybe for the adults, but as a kid, I never had to pull off.
Right. That's really interesting.
In 1969, when Apollo 11 went up, I was in Boy Scout camp in northern New Jersey. We were in New Jersey does have mountains, by the way. Not big ones, but, they brought us all into the mess hall with a TV, with a real fuzzy picture, and we got to watch liftoff. And then a couple of days later, we watched the landing and the Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon, I think that was one of those few collective moments, probably all around the world. The last time something like that had happened was JFK's funeral, probably. And I think I talked about when we did our JFK show, the last episode of Mad Men was on, and when we were talking about JFK's funeral, it was the first time, like everybody, the whole collective community sat by their TV and experienced this thing, electronically. And then the Mad Men wrapped up for the season with the lunar landing, which was the next time that everybody in the world pretty much was glued to their TVs in this with collective experience, and it didn't matter your politics were or anything like that. It was just so amazing.
It's very interesting to talk about, something that transcends politics and nationality, and there's so few things now that we can say, do that, and that's another reason why this NASA social media day was planned for the day that the president announced the NASA budget for this fiscal year. And, that's another thing I do want to speak to because, as a person who, I lived in a household where food was put on the table depending on if my father was successful in what he was doing. And he was a cog in the wheel that was sending these missions up. And I do want to say, I know that everybody does, people are very quick to slam Obama. And I do want to say this, and I'm going to say this in as nonpartisan a way as I can. It is almost miraculous that the NASA budget for this fiscal year is 2.3% higher than it was for last fiscal year, and that is because Barack Obama shoved it through, okay? And that is the truth, because I sat at NASA Space Flight Center during the live announcement at 1:30 p.m. on February 2nd, 2015, when they announced what this fiscal year's budget was going to be. And you have to remember that from a NASA employee standpoint, it's never enough money. But the fact
yeah.
that the budget is 2.3% higher than it was last year, $18.5 billion is earmarked for NASA for this fiscal year. You have to remember that this is a different world than it was on January 27, 1986, the day before the Challenger exploded. Okay?
Right.
You were not Gus Grissom, and you were not laughing and signing a paper that said, put me in the tin can. Okay? You know, it was different. You know, there had to be, you know, that almost, you know, if you look
because
at the timeline, you know, make your own timeline. Make your own timeline. Go on Wikipedia and make your own timeline for NASA, okay, the launches. And you'll see when, all of a sudden, the regroup really happened. And, you know, it is not the same world as it was back in the 60s, 70s.
Right. And if I can chime in, the demographics of what defined an astronaut changed after the space shuttle came about, because up until the space shuttle, the astronauts were test pilots. They were risk takers. They were adventurers.
Right.
Once you could put a vehicle up there that could hold, say, you know, eight people, you didn't need eight test pilots. You needed maybe two, and
right.
that's when they expanded the
that is so interesting.
They cast a wider net of who could be an astronaut. Scientists, professors.
Physicists. Sally Ride was a physicist. She was
right.
She was a layperson. She was a physicist. And it's interesting that you should say that, because you're almost literally correct, okay, because Gus Grissom, there was a joke when I was a kid, okay, and Gus Grissom was 5 feet 5 inches tall. All right, and if you look at any of the pictures of the Mercury 7, you know, if you remember the movie The Right Stuff, that's what that
yep.
movie was about, The Right Stuff. Gus Grissom was a little dinky guy, okay, and they built the cockpit of the original Mercury capsule around him until they realized the other guys couldn't fit. And at the time, it was McDonnell, not McDonnell Douglas. It was pre-McDonnell Douglas. It used to be called McDonnell back in the 60s. And McDonnell called it the Gusmobile because it was built around him, and they had to refit it because somebody like John Glenn, who was a normal size, I think John Glenn was 5'10 or 5'11, and which is the usual height of the astronaut. But you're so right. But I do want to say that, you know, people who just in a knee-jerk way, you know, make comments on social media about, oh, Obama, you know, it's his fault, you know, that the space program, it's not. You know, we just need to step back and be a little bit more thoughtful, you know, about you know, making a statement like that, you know, but you know,
right.
I also wanted to talk, you know, I know that we're running out of time, so I don't want to talk too much.
Oh, no, we have, let me see, the end time is actually at 8:30, so you have, we always try to move it a little bit farther in case we have a really good topic and people, you know, ask questions or people talk about it, and this is one of those times. So
right.
So don't worry, yeah, you can keep talking, no problem. But I was gonna say, I mean, you're absolutely right. I you know, with so, you know, the Obama response that you spoke of. You know, and you're absolutely correct. NASA's changed so much. Of course, the astronauts that we saw prior to the space shuttle were all men, you know, all white men, At least that I remember. I don't remember anybody of color. And if there was someone, forgive me. I just don't remember. I remember the Buzz Aldrins and that type of thing. And then afterward, you had a little bit more of a maybe more of a melting pot where you had women, you had astronauts that were people of color. You know, so it seemed like there seemed to be a turning point with NASA. Now, I don't know if you know why that may have been, or if it was just those people were the ones that really wanted to be astronauts, and those are the people that just, you know, it just happened organically, not by any sort of, you know, attempt to make it look that way. I know, famously, Hillary Clinton wanted to be an astronaut in the 60s and was turned down because she was a girl.
That's a true story. That was the early 60s. I want to say, I know she was 13, and I want to say it was like 1962, 1963. And see, the thing that happened was, I mean, you know, the timing, again, timing is everything in life. And she did write that letter, and she was pretty much, you know, they call it a slap in the face letter. And NASA is not known. And since that time, you know, recently after that happened in like 1962, they didn't always do that. But at the time, there was such a, you know, so many people wanted to be involved in the space program. And you know, we talk about the Mercury 7, and they were all white males, okay? But there was also something that was unofficial, okay? And it was called the Mercury 13. Okay, and this was 1963, I want to say. And it's just really interesting because, you know, you don't know what the timeline was for something like this internally at NASA. But the Mercury 13 were women who were tested physiologically, mentally, you know, put through all the same tests. And it was privately funded. It was not part of the NASA funding. Okay, and you know, to look into having, you know, women astronauts. Now, you know, I do also want to say, for example, I happen to know about the Hillary Clinton letter because I know that she did not save the letter that she received back. Okay, and I wouldn't have either. Okay, if it had been me, I would have torn it into a thousand pieces. Okay, because I was very much like that 10 years later. You know, I wanted to be the class president in fifth grade, and I went to Catholic school, and they said girls were not class president. And I mean, you know, let me tell you something. I became the class co-president. I mean, it was going to happen, you know. So I know with Hillary, okay, you look at, you know, in NASA's defense, very recently, I want to say maybe like 1966, what had happened was Alan Shepard was a very, very interesting person, and I'm not going to get too much into that, but Alan Shepard did go up, was the first man in space, okay? He was not the first to orbit the Earth, John Glenn was, but Alan Shepard was like the man in space, and what happened was, he had developed Meniere's disease, that inner ear, when you have that inner ear imbalance. And he developed that in like 1963, like a year after he got back from space. And he had to have, and it was not just just in name only. He was like the head of the astronaut corps, okay? And he worked for NASA, and he really did so much good work. And when he was the head of the astronaut corps, a young lady around 12 years old sent a letter in 1966, and she said she wanted to be an astronaut. How did she sign up? And it was either Alan Shepard or one of the Mercury 7. It could have been Scott Carpenter because he worked very closely with Alan Shepard, with the head of the astronaut corps, and wrote a letter to her, said, "We do not have female astronauts right now, but we see on the horizon that is a possibility. So you need to do well in school, you need to do well in science. I mean, you know, he gave the, you know, talk that you would give to a 12-year-old, okay, in this letter.
Right.
And she did save the letter, all right? So, you know, to tell you the truth, you know, again, talk about when John F. Kennedy gave the speech that Jeff put on the meeting train Facebook page. Okay, read that
right.
And count on your fingers how many decades it's been since then, and look at how much everything's changed. Okay, the fact
right.
that Sally Ride was not in the service. She was not in the Air Force. She was not a Marine. John Glenn was a Marine. She was not in the service. She went to Stanford University. She answered an ad in the Stanford University newspaper that NASA placed and said, we're looking for people to join the space program. Fill out the application. She filled out the application, and she was one of a handful out of 8,000 applications to that ad in Stanford, you know, the Stanford newspaper, and she became an astronaut. You know, so that was 1978. That's when she joined NASA, I believe, in 1978. So we're talking in 1962, they wrote the slap in the face letter to Hillary Clinton. In 1978, Sally Ride became an astronaut. All right, so, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, quantum leaps, you know.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the space of time seems like a ton, but the fact that in 1977, from 62, I think you said, when Hillary Clinton wrote her letter to 77, I mean, that's 15 years. Now, people would think, oh, that's a long time, 15 years. But really, realistically, that's a really short period of time that they moved from pretty much saying, well, maybe one day, but not right now, or, you know, we're not really interested in you as an astronaut because you're a woman, to Sally Ride answering an ad in the paper, filling out an application, being accepted, and actually it was an astronaut for decades.
Right.
You know, that's moving literally at the speed of light. I mean, you know, when you look at anything else, any other, if we're talking anything government related or anything that has any relation to, if you want to look at this as a civil rights issue, meaning that, you know, you have the same possibility at a job as somebody else that's, you know, white and male, that's huge. I mean, that's really a gigantic leap forward in a very short period of time.
Okay. And from a personal standpoint, you know, I did mention that, you know, I was one of those kids. You know, I used to go to the library. The library saved my life when I was a kid. You know, I'm talking about my dad and that he worked for NASA. And let me tell you, you know, my father was an extraordinarily flawed person, okay? And you know, that said, you know, the library saved me. And I can remember being 11 years old in 1972 and going to the library and reading a new magazine that came out called Ms. And I remember reading that magazine and feeling like, oh, my gosh, this all rings so true to me. This is me. And I was 11, okay? And I want to tell you that on National Social Media Day, on February 2nd, 2015, I was standing in this huge room with I always use the term box, okay? This big box that was like the size of your kitchen, okay? And this woman came out to talk to us, and she was the project manager for this project that they're working on with the space station, with the International Space Station. And this woman walked up to me, and she was my peer. She was African-American. She was in her mid-50s. And that woman proceeded in 4 minutes to explain that whole project to people like me who have a high school education. Okay, and I looked at her, and again, my eyes must have been, it was that moment when I was 11 years old reading this magazine saying, oh my gosh, there's a future for people like me. And that woman stood there, and she said she'd been working at NASA since 1983. And her enthusiasm, her quiet enthusiasm, you know, the whole thing, I stood there, and I mean, I just was I mean, in our lifetimes, we have seen, and it's never enough, okay? It'll never be enough, okay? All you have to hear is one instance of sexism or racism, and you're railing, you're shaking your fist. But let me tell you something. I stood there, and I looked in that woman's eyes, and she was standing an arm's length away from me. And let me tell you something. In 1965, when I stood there with my father, there were no women there. There wasn't a woman that worked there except for a secretary, except for the lady who served you your macaroni and cheese at the cafeteria. Okay, and,
wow.
And this is my lifetime. Okay, so you know, and this is something, if you are a space geek or if you are, you know, a geek in any way, don't be shy to go out there and tell the cashier at Giant or at the supermarket how, oh, did you see the moon? Oh, my gosh, it's so gorgeous tonight. There's like a ring around the moon. Did you see it? Oh, you got to look. When you got, you know, don't underestimate how you can light the fire under someone. You know what I mean? And you know, the changes that have, you know, that Sally Ride, you know, Sally Ride in a very quiet way because she was a very, very private person. Okay, you have the Buzz Aldrin. You have the Gus Grissom. You have the John Glenn who are out there with their personal life. Well, Sally Ride was a physicist, and she loved space, and she loved NASA, but she did not talk about her private life. Okay, but let me tell you something. She was a professor at the University of California, San Diego, most of her career, okay? And she lit the fire under so many men and women. You know, so, you know.
Did we lose you? Yeah,
sorry.
No, I'm still here. I just have to
Cut
my phone.
Like start
to snowball, you know.
I just kind of get concerned because sometimes we have technical issues. Yeah. But I was going to say, Jeff, I think you were going to try to make a comment earlier, or.
No, I just wanted to just share my non-scientific memories as a kid, and I think I did, you know. Of you know, watching this thing evolve from Alan Shepard, you know, going up, you know, staying up there for a few minutes and coming down, and then John Glenn's orbiting, and then just the way it went from a one-man capsule to a two-man capsule. Then they did spacewalks. You know, Ed White did the first spacewalk. He died in fire with Gus Grissom in Apollo 1. And then the way Apollo was, you know, staged, you know, to each time they went up, they did something extra, and then they finally landed on the moon. And also, what sometimes we forget, there were about a half a dozen other, I don't know the exact number, moon landings after the first moon landing.
Right. And that's
and, like, who could even name? I remember Alan Shepard was on one of them.
Right.
I remember he putted a golf ball on the moon.
Right.
But I can't name a single astronaut who landed on the moon after Apollo 11. And that's unfortunate because
right.
It became commonplace.
Oh, right.
And then they went to the moon. And I'll say, like, in 1969, when 2001 Space Odyssey came out, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that by the year 2001, we were going to be all over the moon. You know,
we're going to be living there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Here we are, 14 years after 2001, and we have to rely on the Russians to send a spaceship up to pick up our own guys, our own astronauts, and bring them back to Earth.
Right.
We don't have the technology to do it. What the fuck?
And, you
know,
that is an interesting. That's very interesting that you should talk about that because, you know, the Russians, you know, I don't know if this, you know, the whole reason that any of this happened, you know, that we went to the moon. I mean, really, you know, I remember my father in the late 50s, he worked on the launch of a, in quotes, weather satellite, and it was called the Nimbus, okay? And that went up. The reason that went up was because that Gary Francis Powers, you know, I don't know if you remember him, but he went up and was doing reconnaissance over Russia, and he crashed, and they got caught. Okay, the Russians caught him, okay? And then the Russians sent up.
I remember this now. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I remember what you're talking about. The name hit me fine. Okay. Yeah, I remember this.
Oh, my gosh. When Sputnik went up, people like my father, oh, my gosh, that killed them. That was a knife in the gut. I mean, that was just unbelievable that we would allow the Russians to, in quotes, beat us into space. Okay. And the reason that that Nimbus weather satellite went up was one of the first, you know, if it weren't for the Nimbus satellite, and there was a Nimbus 1, and then there was Nimbus 2, and Nimbus 2 is still up there, okay, and if it weren't for those weather satellites, there would be no GPS, okay, and that's another thing that I really learned so much. Talk about fast forward. You know, when I was at the social media day at NASA, you know, I don't know if you all have ever heard of these beacons that you can buy at places like L.L. Bean and REI, you know, the outdoor places, and they're beacons, and they look like a walkie-talkie, and you know, for people who don't know what a walkie-talkie is, you're not as old as me,
We know.
This is something I learned about NASA. That did you know that NASA has a search and rescue arm? And when I talk about search and rescue, I mean you and me and normal people. Okay. And you can go to REI or L.L. Bean and buy one of these beacons and put it on your boat. Like, let's say you have a pleasure craft, and you put it on your boat, and you're going to go fishing. And, of course, you know, you're going to check the weather and make sure there's no hurricanes coming. But let's say something happens, and you get stuck, and you're out in the middle of the ocean or something like that. If you have one of these beacons that you can buy, you can go buy one. You can get one online, okay, at Amazon. If you have one of these beacons, NASA will come and rescue you. NASA, they have a search and rescue arm. And you should look it up because it's absolutely fascinating. And anybody can get one. And, I mean, the fact that is what the space program has done for people like you and me. You know, I mean, Jeff, you talked about being at Boy Scout camp in northern New Jersey, and, when the moon landing or whatever, and I mean, you know, Boy Scouts have these beacons, and you can, you know, buy one for your kid if your kid is going to be going, you know, hiking or something like that, and you're like, you know, just do me a favor, do it for your old man, put it in your backpack, you know, and I mean,
wow.
You know, this is what NASA does that people don't know about, okay, and you know, so many other, you know, one thing I did want to mention, you know, it was interesting, Jeff, when you were talking about Apollo 8, which went up during Christmas of 1968, that terrible year. And, you know, I remember, I'll never forget one of the astronauts, and the astronauts that went up, and I hope I remember them right, Frank Borman was one of them. Maybe you recognize that name. James Lovell was another one, and he worked at Mission Control on many of the launches. And also William Anders went up to look back at the Earth and take those pictures, Jeff, that you were talking about. And
yep.
I remember one of those astronauts on Christmas Day saying, please be informed, there is a Santa Claus. And I will never forget that. As an eight-year-old, I will never forget that because I still believed in Santa when I was 8 years old. And when an astronaut said it, I knew it was true. You know what I mean? And you know, and also one thing that's very important to remember is that every launch that went up, Jeff, just like you said, each craft that went up, the next ones that went up, okay, Apollo 1, and then you have Apollo 8, and then you have Apollo 11, okay, you have Apollo 17 was the last one, okay, in 1972. Exponentially, more was done, building on what was learned by the previous launch. For example, Apollo 8, which was the first one to orbit the Earth, to go to, you know, it did not land on the moon, but it orbited the moon. Okay, that was in December of 1968, if I'm not mistaken. In that craft was a dummy lunar module. Okay, so they had the lunar module, everything in it that was going to go up for Apollo 11, which was in Apollo 8 except for the people. All right, so they carried that up there to see if it could be done. You know, so much, you know, and I don't remember, I don't know if you all remember this, but speaking of cameras, Javi, you were mentioning the camera and how, you know, the quantum leap that we made because of the cameras that went up in space because of NASA. The first time they went up there, they took the camera and they, by mistake, one of the astronauts turned the camera toward the sun and it blew the camera.
Oh, wow.
I'll never forget that. My father's saying, no, they blew the camera. And I'm like, what do you mean they blew the camera? The camera is useless. They can't. And I don't know, you might even, if you think about that, you might remember, Jeff, having seen that boom, the transmission went out, because one of the guys just turned, and when he turned, he had the camera in his hand, and it happened to turn toward the sun, and it blew the camera.
That's hilarious. And Jeff, now I'm getting, Jeff, I was going to say that now I'm getting a little bit of hold on a second. Oh, there it goes. Okay. So, Jeff, we have about 13 minutes left or so. Somewhere around that number. Did you have, because we do have a caller. I don't know if I can bring him on because now this thing's freaking out again like we get at the beginning. So it's, right now it's working. I can... We do have a caller that may have a question. We have about 12 and a half minutes left.
Okay. Yeah.
Did you have anything left to add or
no,
what?
I think if we want to talk about the future, like the Orion, that would probably
be
a whole other hour. But let's let the caller on.
Okay. All right. Let me grab the caller. Okay. All right, caller. You're on. Who is this?
Howdy, it's Michael from New York City.
Hi. Hi.
Hello,
Michael.
Heidi,
what was your question? What was your question for Kathy? We don't have a lot of time, so we only have about 11 and a half minutes. So.
Right. Okay. Well, it's just two quick questions. Number one, I did not hear how long she was with NASA. I was just wondering. I'm sure she remembers about the Challenger. Back in 1986, and at that time I was just a supermarket cashier, and so on my way to work, I heard what had happened. So I was wondering, how did that affect her? Like, what was she doing at the time that Challenger exploded and just shocked everybody?
Oh,
and the
God.
Second, you want the second question as well?
Sure.
Why don't we have her answer the first one first, then we can go to the second.
Yeah.
Very well.
I want to say that I never worked for NASA. My father did. And at the time, I remember I was working actually down in D.C. At the time of the Challenger. And the company that I worked for ExxonMobil for many years in their patent department. And which is another story that has a lot to do with plastic, you know, which is one thing that NASA definitely has developed their plastic, you know, in the United States. But when I was working at ExxonMobil, that's when the Challenger exploded. And I remember one of our engineers coming in, and he said, and I knew him well, his name was Jeff, and I knew him well, and he came in and he said, Kathy, he said, the Challenger has exploded. And when he looked at me, I knew that that really happened. And all the other people in the office started laughing because they absolutely did not believe it. I mean, it was a complete, absolute, it could not have happened. And I also want to mention, when it comes to, when you talk about the Challenger, the company at the time that made the O-ring, okay, everybody knows that term,
right.
O-ring, okay,
yep.
The seal,
yep.
Just real basically, okay, the solid rocket booster, you know, gets kind of, for lack of a better term, jettisoned off of the rocket after it does its work, get the liftoff. And there are two O-rings, okay, and one of them does the work, and if something should happen and it fails, the second one seals the gases inside the solid rocket booster. There was an engineer who worked for Morton Thiokol, and I'll never forget him because he was a hero. And he, his name was Roger Beaujolais, and it's not spelled like the wine, but it's pronounced just like the wine.
Sorry.
And he, in 1985, told his bosses the O-rings are good. They're no good.
Yep.
And those bosses said, look, pal, they said, look, you're an engineer. You need to start thinking like a manager. And he goes,
yeah.
Look, you know, and anyway, long story short, you know, that man really did try to save those people's lives, and it was just not going to be done. And now Morton Thiokol is not called that anymore. It is just called Thiokol, but it still exists, and it's still.
I think they went bankrupt. Renamed themselves.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Hey, Kathy, I was going to tell you that that story you just told about the gentleman, you know, figuring out the O-rings. I've had when I was working on my master's degree, they used that story quite prominently to show you the difference between being a leader and being a manager. It was key. Yeah, it was a very, very enlightening when you read what his management was telling him, and he's like, no, you don't understand. This is what's going to happen, and they're pretty much saying, well, go away and don't worry about it. And it was amazing. So we have seven minutes left. What was your thought there, Kathy? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's all right. Go ahead.
No, so what was I interrupted your thought there. Did you have something else there?
Talk about a moving train. You know, excuse the pun. I mean, it was almost like, hey, buddy, you're not stopping this train. This train is on track, and it's moving, and it's not stopping. And, I mean, you know, all it takes is one person doing the right thing. And, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to throw yourself, you know, are you going to stop the countdown? I mean, you know, really, you know, it's just really bad. You know, that was just terrible, terrible, terrible.
Can I ask one more question before I go?
Right, sure. It'll happen quick. We have six minutes.
Yeah, it's going to be real quick. When you backtrack, say, to the 60s and 70s, we had TV series like Star Trek and Space 1999, and then you fast forward to some of the movies like Lost in Space, Gravity, all these movies focusing on space exploration and space colonization, and they seem to be really digging deep into what it's like out in space. I wasn't sure, and maybe Kathy can emphasize, are these films being pretty much informative and giving us insight into the future that is approaching to us, or is it just entertainment?
You know, I that is really a fascinating perspective, and something that is definitely discussed, you know, being in a NASA family, one thing that was definitely discussed was the ethics of space travel and space you know, colonization and exploration. And that is really something that right now, and at NASA, when I was there in February, just a month ago, you know, that is something that is talked about, is going to Mars, okay? Now, if one were to go to Mars, there is a very good chance that you're not going to, you know, if you get back, the people that you left on Earth are either going to be dead or they're going to be significantly different. All right, so then you're going to get into the question of, do you only, and really think about this after we hang up tonight. You know, what do you do? Do you only look for people who are unmarried? Okay, and then that gets you into a whole different, you know, set of psychological circumstances. Because if you're not married, you know, maybe that means that you don't have a certain amount of, you know, life experiences. And if you're a woman, does that mean that you're never going to be able to give birth? You know, and if you do give birth in space, you know, are you an American? You know, you go on and on, you know, talking about just the ethical. I mean, so you want to talk about there being, you know, what's going to happen with the space race or space travel? What's going to happen? How's it going to change? You know, between, you know, what we knew in the 60s with everything happening so quickly, you know, and between now and you're talking about going to Mars. And I mean, how about somebody like me? You know, I want to go, but I'm old. Why would they want an old person? Right? Think about that.
You know, Kathy, wow. I think that we need to have another show just focusing on the future of NASA and just this question of space travel and that type of thing.
I think this
topic is epically fascinating for most of us that are on, I'm sure. Now, Jeff, we have 3 minutes left exactly, so. I know that I want to really thank you, Kathy, for coming on tonight, because this is one of those subjects I can geek out on, like I said before, for a very long time. And so, you know,
I appreciate so much you guys even asking me, because I'm so humbled by having had this experience. And, you know, when Jeff asked me to talk, I was just so nervous, because I'm thinking, you know, I'm not a scientist. I mean, you know, I love NASA and I love space. So I know, I hear your enthusiasm, and it's just, my gosh, kindred spirit, definitely.
Yeah, we're cool. We're about regular people here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, so we'll definitely have you on again. You can talk to Jeff. He's a much better scheduler than I am. So. But yeah, so you can talk to Jeff about, you know, having another show in the future, whenever it works out. And, you know, and like I said, going to the future would be, you know, talking about space in the future, which we really didn't touch on much. You know, Michael asked a good question regarding space travel and that type of thing. So, but yeah, so we'd love to have you on again. So, Jeff, we have about a minute and 30 seconds. Do you want to have the final word?
Okay. I'm going to go off topic just for a second. Tomorrow, we have theater tickets to see the new Larry David play on Broadway called Fish in the Dark. We're going to the Wednesday afternoon matinee, and I'm so excited about that. I can barely contain myself.
Tonight,
Christmas Eve. And you'll hear all about it.
Your doppelganger.
That's right. All right. That's all I have to say. And I'm done. And you guys can take it from here.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks a lot, Kathy. We'll have you on again. And thanks to Michael for asking great questions this evening. And for everyone who listened, thanks for coming to our little show in the sky. Everybody have a great evening.
And everybody.
Bye-bye. Yes, it's all perfect. Thank you. Bye-bye.